Welcome to episode 7 of The Tech Bubble. I'm your host, Ian Williamson, and today we have a very special one-off episode in which we are joined by no less than 3 school principals at South Island School, dating back as far as 2001. That predates even my arrival in 2004. Right the way through to the current administration. They are here to discuss all things tech-related, spanning Web 2.0, the digital revolution, the advent of the one-to-one laptop program, the rise of coding, and digital skills, just to name a few. However, before we start, some news in terms of how to listen to this podcast, and indeed the 6 episodes recorded earlier in the year. All of our content can now be found on Anchor and Spotify. And of course, we've got the South Island School YouTube channel as well. That should keep you covered in terms of whichever platform is your favorite. As if this was not enough, we are mixing up the format for our new season. More student participation, I hear you cry. Don't worry, we're one step ahead of you. As today, I am joined by Chloe Jazzy Lau, regular guest on the show and now promoted to co-host. Chloe, congratulations on your excellent IGCSE results, first of all. Mr. Vignoles said to the staff at the start of this term that we need to begin thinking of ourselves as an online school. So no longer a temporary state of affairs, but rather this is currently the status quo. Do you think that that mindset is filtered down to the students yet, Chloe?
Good to be back on the podcast, and I'm incredibly excited to be co-hosting. Going back to your question, Mr. Williamson, I think the mindset of online school has, for the most part, been adopted by students. In fact, more importantly for most students, especially senior students, that did not come without having to reevaluate their habits or set up new ground rules for self-restraint. So I'm saying that I'm fairly optimistic, but I believe that most of us will emerge as better students with a bit more versatility when it comes to adapting to different learning formats.
Thanks, Chloe. That's not all in terms of student participation. Far from it. Welcome back to the show to Rohan Williamson, the Namas House Captain, and guest in our trial show way back in February, I believe, many moons ago. Once again, congratulations on some excellent IGCSE results, Rohan. I don't know who your parents are, but they must have done a great job given your success. Oh, and by the way, the teachers did a good job too.
Hi, it's great to be back on the show. Thanks for having me.
And our final student guest, also a veteran of the tech bubble. He last appeared in episode 6 and he's back again by popular demand. Welcome to our Year 13 DLC representative, Paul Kim.
Oh, I'd say the word veteran is a little bit strong there. I've only been on one other episode.
You've ruined it, Paul. You've ruined it. You've ruined your big intro.
But it's an absolute pleasure to be back, Mr. Williamson and Chloe. And pleasure to meet you, Mr. Ray. And it's great to see you again, Mr. Silverthorne. And hope you're doing well, Mr. Vignoles.
Great to have all 3 of you on the show and some really strong student participation. Well, as Paul mentioned, there are 3 very special guests on the show today, starting with the current incumbent of the principal role at South Island School. You know who I'm talking about, our very own Tom Vignoles. Tom arrived at South Island School back in 2018 and has overseen what must have been the most turbulent time that the school has seen in its long history. Was it something you said, do you think, Tom? T10s wreaking devastation on Nam Fung Road, massive protests in Hong Kong, and then COVID-19, just when Tom thought things were calming down. It's great to have you on the show, Tom.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be here. Was it something I said? Well, possibly. I have been thinking back to my interview for the role, and I certainly will have mentioned my time in Rio de Janeiro, where in 4 years, certainly we had our fair share of interesting events to respond to. Never a dull moment in Rio. But actually, my first experience of crisis management as a member of the leadership team was back in 2011 when I was working in the UK, and something that was called the Icelandic volcano went off and shut European airspace. It was interesting hearing this on the BBC News. It was always the Icelandic volcano, the nameless one was the sort of implication. And nobody could actually say the name. Nobody except me. It was actually called Eyjafjallajökull. You heard it here. And the reason I learned it was because at the time I was in charge of staff cover, I was in charge of school trips, and I was in charge of international students. And it was the first day of term, and we had staff who were stuck in Barbados, of all places. There was almost, visceral anger from the rest of the staff to learn somebody was stuck on holiday in Barbados. We had a school trip stuck in the USA, and we had international students who were stranded in places like the UK, Ukraine, and couldn't travel overland because they couldn't get a visa for the countries in between. And so I found myself in charge of leading that. And the interesting thing is, nobody at all thought of piping in all of these people via Zoom or any other digital platform. It just wasn't in the discussion. So times have changed positively despite the current situation. And it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on the show. And welcome also to my two fellow principals. Great to see you.
Have you thought about introducing Icelandic into the school curriculum, Tom? That was very well pronounced, by the way.
Yes, the spelling is even more difficult. I think if I did, it would definitely be Icelandic ab initio. And I think a predicted grade of above a 2 in the IB would be considered quite an achievement. So it's not highest on my list right now, but I defer to the students if it's something they'd like to learn.
One for the development plan, I think, going forward. Rohan, you'll be very excited by that. You've wanted to go to Iceland for years. So there you go. You've got your personal tutor and he'll get you up to a promised level 2, he said. Okay, second up, it just goes to show how inclusive we are on this show, given that our second guest is a Manchester United fan. He was principal for 7 years, spanning the period between 2010 and 2017. Graham Silverthorne oversaw some big changes at South Island School, including our adoption of ISAMs, integrated management systems, that is, coaching, a change in the house system, massive move, an expansion in the Wi-Fi hardware in school, incredibly important going forward, and so much more. Seems incredible that this was as long ago as 2017 that you left, Graham. So great to have you on the show. How are things over in Singapore at UWC East?
Hi, and they're pretty good. I have to say it's very nice to see everyone this morning and be part of the South Island community again, if only for an hour. Really nice to see John again, and who doesn't ever seem to get any older. I don't know what the secret is, John, but I want to buy a bottle of it. Tom, I'm not going to comment. Nice to see everybody else on the broadcast. Singapore's good. It's not Hong Kong. I miss Hong Kong. I really do. That's a fact. It's a shame I can't even get over to visit anymore at the moment. But Singapore's fairly calm at the moment. It's been a quite intense 3 years, as it would have been for Tom. My 2020 started with an extended experience of Singaporean haze, which shut the schools for long periods of time and made us all wear masks even before Christmas. And then we pretty seamlessly slipped into COVID-19, and the rest is history. It's been an interesting experience, and one that's, I think, helped me grow as a leader. But I still think back very fondly to my days in Hong Kong, with the exception of people, obviously, who wore grey shirts with white sleeves.
Thank you very much, Graham. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, of course, that was the Indonesian episode, wasn't it? With the pollution that was coming across at that point. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a fairly regular event. The where in Hong Kong you're looking for your T3 signs, over here we all look at the map and look at the number of fires that are burning around us and joining up into large smoke clouds, which make it very hard to breathe. We have alerts on the school tower that ring every time the air gets to a certain level, and we also have a lot of lightning. More lightning strikes in Singapore than anywhere else in Asia, so it's a dangerous place to be dodging in and out of buildings here, I can tell you.
I bet it is. Okay then, so last but by no means least, the man who employed me, folks. I still remember the day well in London when I went for an interview with John Ray and Graham Ranger. I very nearly didn't bother. The reason? Well, several teachers in the waiting room area had huge plastic folders with what appeared to be journals of work. I nearly convinced myself that I was out of my league and had no chance. In fact, my only reason for staying was the scolding I knew I was likely to get from my wife if I left without at least trying. Just as well, later I discovered that they were not media teachers, but rather design technology teachers. Anyway, John perhaps witnessed the biggest changes of all between 2001 and 2010. The one-to-one laptop scheme, the opening of the Apple Service Center, the decommissioning of 4 computer labs, Web 2.0, Octopus cards. Blimey, how did you survive all of that, John? Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's so nice to be reconnecting with the South Island community. So great to be invited onto this show. I really appreciate that. And it's really special for me to connect with Tom for the first time and reconnect with Graham, who I know, obviously, as we overlapped at South Island. My time at South Island was pretty turbulent, too. Not as turbulent as is currently going on. Ian, I think you may not remember that we lived through SARS. I certainly lived through SARS. I think you may be a year later.
That's right.
coming from the UK, where I was a principal in a public school in the UK, but I'd survived the foot and mouth disease, which required me closing the school for 3 weeks. And here I was at South Island again. We closed the school, I think, for about 3 weeks back in the SARS time. And of course, I had no idea that what I was walking into when I came to Canada and the current pandemic. So I don't tout myself as a pandemic expert, but I'm beginning to wonder that I keep having these pandemic experiences, whichever school that I go to. So you're right about IT between 2001 and 2010. It certainly was a very interesting time and a challenging time too. Things were changing pretty radically. And we had to make some pretty big decisions. And I know that we'll talk about those a bit later on in the show. But it's really good to join you and really good to connect with the students on the show too.
Good to have you on the show, Mr. Ray. If I may begin with you, as I'm sure many of our listeners would be fascinated to hear about SIS before all of our students, and that is even before those in year 13 were born. Now, tech is very much come and gone during that time, including the interactive whiteboards. Can you describe for us the learning curve with tech of this nature at the time, with your perspective as principal?
Chloe, that makes me feel terribly old to know that our year 13s, we weren't born when I started at SIS, but I'll carry on nevertheless. The whole kind of interactive whiteboard, smart board kind of initiative was a really interesting one. And when I look back on that now, and it's very easy to be wise after the event, so to speak, the interactive whiteboards took us in a direction, really, which wasn't terribly helpful in terms of where I think schools were trying to go in terms of learning. So South Island, like many schools, spent a great deal of money on installing these interactive whiteboards. We spent hundreds of hours of time training our staff so that they could almost be like magicians in front of these wonderful, you know, interactive devices. And for one or two of our teachers, they got on top of it and they developed really high level skills in terms of their presentation skills using all the different tools available to them. But to be honest, it was, you know, at a time of quite significant technology change, digital change, and many of our teachers really struggled to learn how to use all the tools available. So what tended to happen after a period of time was that because they didn't learn the tools, because they weren't able to really get on top of them, the interactive whiteboards became just very expensive projector screens, to be very honest. They weren't used to anywhere near their full potential. But the other interesting dimension of this is that when they were used to their full potential, it really meant that within a lesson, there was far too much focus on teaching and the teacher being some kind of magician in front of the class. And what we realized after a while was that wasn't the direction that we wanted teaching and learning to go. The emphasis was becoming much more on teachers being great facilitators of learning and just not the imparter of knowledge, you know, with these kind of bells and whistles tools in their hands. So I often look back and say the worst tech decision I've ever made was putting interactive whiteboards and smart boards into every classroom.
They just weren't interactive, were they, John? That's what I remember. I mean, you know, the name of them, it changed, didn't it, from interactive to just electronic whiteboard, I think, halfway through that process. And I think they were sold as devices that were going to be highly interactive with classes. And that did start to happen, you know, a few years afterwards. But it took a lot of years to get the pedagogy to that stage.
Yeah, I think that's right, Ian. And because I now teach in a K through 13 school, I do see in the elementary junior school, I see teachers engaging students far more in the interactive nature of these digital whiteboards than was the case in secondary schools.
And it's interesting to chart that change via the maths department in particular. I mean, I can remember that Charlie Martin, then Charlie Mitchell, who was a teacher who joined us at that time, and now I think is at Dulwich College, actually, over where you are, Graham, in Singapore. I believe that she was a great advocate of those electronic whiteboards in the early days, whilst, you know, my wife, who works here in a primary school in Hong Kong, still made use of the EWB kind of slides until, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. Now, the maths department seems to be routinely making use of the iPad. In fact, so much so that, Rohan, you bought one for the academic year ahead. And I would like to point out, everyone, by the way, this was out of his own pocket. There was no way I was going to buy him it after I'd already forked out for his laptop as well. So, Ryan, how are you finding that iPad use at the moment?
Well, I think that was a very interesting point in itself. But to go back to what you were previously saying, Mr. Ray, I think that the iPad allows for far more student input than was previously the case before, as there are just loads of fantastic note-taking apps, to name a few, such as Notability and GoodNotes. And what makes these tools so powerful is that instead of having to just copy down what's on the whiteboard into your book, teachers can share their digital notes with their students via the Google Classroom, and it allows these students to fully immerse themselves in the lesson and fully engage, as opposed to only half listening whilst trying to frantically copy down everything before the teacher then moves on to their next point. I do think that many would argue that you could just take a photo of what's on the board with your phone. However, I find that these note-taking apps allow you to embed the teacher's notes as an image, and then using the tools within that app, the students can further customize and annotate their notes to really suit their style of learning. And as everything is digital these days, it's now much easier, perhaps than ever, to just move these notes into other applications such as Google Drive, which we use very regularly in school. And apps like Notability actually have this as a function within their system software. So I think it's really interesting the transformation that note-taking has taken to become more digital. I'd also like to argue that it is a lot more environmentally friendly than using paper. So that's just a few reasons, to name a few, why I'm such a big advocate for digital note-taking.
And it's instantaneous, isn't it? I mean, Dr. Bushell, I think, is your maths teacher this year, and you know, once he's finished drawing out whatever he's got to do on the iPad, I guess those notes can be transferred across to you as the students pretty much straight away.
Absolutely.
Oh, and also, on the note of taking photos, there are a lot more sophisticated scanning apps, such as Cam Scanner, that I'm sure most of us use to scan, in fact, our GCSE mock exams when our exams got cancelled. So that's a very interesting way to lead into the dawn of tech at South Island School. One development stemming from your time at SIS, Mr. Ray, is very much still with us, and that is the introduction of the one-to-one laptop scheme. In fact, both Mr. Williamson, Rohan, and I were involved in the laptop induction evening for parents that was conducted via Zoom last week. So, Mr. Ray, what are your memories, what are your most fond memories of the driving forces behind that decision at the time?
Thanks, Chloe. I referenced that the interactive whiteboard decision was probably my worst tech decision. I think the move to one-to-one laptop scheme was, I think, probably the best decision. We were one of the first schools, certainly within the ESF group, to move in this direction. And it was it's a natural step, of course, which all schools subsequently around the world have made. You know, we had a situation when I first came to South Island in 2001 where we had laptops on carts that used to be taken around the school to various classrooms when the teachers deemed that they were going to be useful to support learning. So it was a crazy situation, you know, that there wasn't enough of them. Often, you know, they were not charged or reliable. Often, you know, they came late for the moment in the lesson when the teacher wanted the students to open the laptops and use a particular application. So it was a very natural step for us to be able to move to a one-to-one environment. And I think, you know, I'll kind of reference this back to, you know, where does the locus of control lay in the whole learning process? You know, the great thing that the one-to-one technology gave to us was it shifted the control, you know, from the teacher deciding when technology could be used, you know, much more potentially to the students to be making decisions around when technology would best support their learning.
John, do you remember the presentation at the time when we made the decision that we were going to go to the one-to-one laptop scheme, and we invited representatives from Apple and Microsoft into the school, and then of course subsequently making the decision to go with Apple?
I do, Ian. You know, and frankly, you know, I was hugely dependent on people like you and the head of IT, Nick Vilpra, at the time. You'll remember. I'll be the first to say, and you know, probably this applies to many principals, I'm not a tech expert by any means. So I was pretty much out of my depth deciding, should we go to PC or Apple at the time? And you know, I think this was one of the times in which, you know, Apple had taken a great leap forward in terms of developing expertise around the vision and the use of tech in schools, in education and learning. And so, You know, we had presentations, you know, and I remember the presentation from the PC guys very much. It was about the nature of the hardware and so on. And then we had presentations from the Apple team who came in and talked a bit about the hardware and all the, you know, the potential. But they also talked very much about potential of the of not only Apple hardware, but Apple software in terms of really enhancing learning. Plus, they'd also led the way, I think, in potentially giving teachers tools to be able to manage the students' use of technology as well. You know, plus at the time, you know, I have to admit it, you know, that an Apple hasn't changed very much. You know, kind of, you know, they have a sexy marketing team, and it's hard not to be seduced by those things. So at the end of the day, you know, I think we had teachers involved, we had parents involved, students involved in this decision. And I think at the end of the day, it was pretty clear cut to move down the Apple route. So, you know, we ended up, it was an incredible time. Literally from 1 month to the next, we went from no one-to-one technology through to everybody having 1,300 people having Apple laptops. So that was kind of a major, major decision. It weighed on me heavily, but absolutely looking back, it was the right one.
Actually, we were early adopters, really, weren't we? When you look back now, I mean, at the time, I probably wasn't aware of this in the same way, but we were early adopters of the technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I referenced ESF, but even in Hong Kong, there was only one other school that was considering taking this step. I remember visiting Canadian International School just down the road. They were also thinking about making that leap. Yes, it felt risky at the time, but of course, looking back, as I say, it was absolutely the right and natural thing to do.
Mr. Ray, just from a student's perspective, I think that was a brilliant decision, first of all. Mac products are incredibly versatile. They're very interconnected. And in fact, a few weeks ago, our DLC team actually put together a series of Mac OS introduction videos for year 7. So that turned out great. Mr. Silverthorne, first, I'm sure I speak for many of the senior students who remember your time as school principal with very fond memories, and it is truly great to speak to you again. Can I start by asking you to compare the tech-related challenges between your time at SIS with your last 2 years at UWC?
Thank you, Chloe. It's lovely to see you as well. Yeah, it's interesting. If I can deviate from the question slightly, John's story just now put in mind an experience I had, which really perhaps brings into focus the way things were changing really rapidly at that time. I arrived at South Island 2010 to this wonderful one-to-one scenario that John had put in place. But I think about probably a year or 2 years after I came to Hong Kong, I was invited back to my previous school in the UK, which is a very large high school in a small town outside of Bristol. In leaving, I'd been successful in gaining a grant from them to build a new building, which is a £2 million building. And very kindly, they named it after me. So I have a building named after me, which is one of those things that you don't expect in life. But I went back to the school for the opening of the building, and I was given a tour of all of the rooms by the exciting new principal, and it was lovely. But they kept the pièce de résistance for the last door, and the last door they opened as we arrived at the centre of the space. The principal threw the door open, and there was a computer room. And I hadn't seen one for 2 years because in South Island, we didn't have them anymore. They were all, I don't even know where the computer rooms were at South Island. They'd all been turned into something else. And it really brought into sharp focus for me how this kind of disruptive, rapid change was. We were right in the middle of it then, and John was right at the cutting edge of that process. So it was really, really interesting. So anyway, to answer your question, sorry to deviate. I was lucky, actually. I went into UWC SEA in Singapore into a pretty similar environment. They were already one-to-one Mac, I think slightly behind John's initiative. And I think that is such a critical experience now for teachers who come into new schools and students who come to new schools. Without that kind of G Suite Mac experience, you really struggle if you have to cross the line from one side to the other. And I dream of a day when that isn't an impediment to people's moving processes, because schools, you know, do commit wholeheartedly to one way or the other. A lot of our students, we have boarders in the schools, many of them coming from China, and some of them are completely bemused by engaging with the Google Suite, the G Suite, and the Apple software. So I was lucky, I think, in the sense that I knew the environment, but there were huge challenges in my context, in my new context, because SEA has got 5,600 students, and it's split across two campuses in Singapore. They're both K-12 schools, and because the needs of an infant school, I mean, John will know this, the needs of an infant school are not the same as the needs of a high school. I came into a very mixed and I think probably not entirely planned economy of different devices and different softwares. So the primary school were using, do use laptops, do use iPads, and the rest of the school use laptops. The primary software is something called Seesaw, which is a nice way for parents and staff and students to remain connected. In the middle school, we use a bespoke learning platform. The high school start to segue into ManageBack. So there is a complex management system. It just makes the point of if you were starting again from scratch, you probably wouldn't do it the way we've done it. But most schools don't get that luxury. They tend to evolve. When you get a school as big as the one I'm in now, you get some kind of polarized decision making where people go for what they recognize, what they like, and then they promote what they believe in, and it can create some problems. The danger in a very large organization, I think this would probably apply to businesses with subdivisions as well as to schools, if you get to a point where there's a major size issue, you have to be careful you don't have local decision making, which creates complexity to join things up. One of the things I've always had in my mind is if you arrive in UWC as a parent and a young student, your journey through K-12 is not only a learning journey, it's how to learn the new technology in this part of the school journey, which isn't necessarily helpful for promoting understanding. I just finished by saying that one of the exciting aspects of what I'm doing now is that SEA is part of a global network of 18 schools. Many of them are boarding schools, many of them quite remote, and they've been seriously hit by pandemic issues to a point where we've now set up a global shared learning resource, and we're starting to investigate the possibilities of working together in a virtual sense. That's exciting, but also very challenging when you get into time zone issues.
What does that look like, the global shared learning resource, Graham? That sounds really exciting, but what does that actually entail?
Well, at the minute, we've been writing courses. We have a specific focus in terms of learning, and we create courses. Things like peace building will be an example where students from across the movement can come together and understand techniques and developmental ways of building peaceful relationships between discontinuous populations. So this course has been written. It's been posted up on our global network, which is a software run by a company called Teamy, and we will have learners now who can access the same resources globally. The next step is to try and develop some synchronous learning opportunities that may be half globe rather than whole globe. But we're putting quite a lot of resource into that at the moment, and it's front edge stuff. It's complicated.
I'd be interested to hear more about that. And of course, there's so much written at the moment about the potential for, you know, augmented reality, virtual reality in these kind of online teaching environments. So I wonder whether we're on the cusp of another kind of huge change where, you know, 20 years ago, what we're doing just now, speaking on Zoom across all these different countries, the type of online education that we're offering at the moment would have been unthinkable to us. It does beg the question, I wonder what things are going to be like in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, and what you're speaking about there, Graham. Sounds like that may well be a big part of how things, you know, pan out. We'll be interested to hear more about that on the show if you're available sometime in the future, by the way, Graham. You mentioned there the significance of online learning, which, whether you've heard the episode, I'm not sure, Graham, but it featured heavily when we discussed that very topic with Carolyn Andrews, who you remember, and Lucy Pervaise, two of our SIS VPs. And that was back in episodes 2 and 3 of The Tech Bubble. Did you notice the seamless way, by the way, everybody, that I managed to get a little bit of shameless marketing in there? But here we are, 5 months later, and surely worldwide we are learning from our mistakes and perhaps refining our approach to the online process. The mindfulness, for instance, of both staff and students has been widely discussed. Graham, do you think that you've changed your view of technology in light of the events of 2020 itself?
Yes. I mean, I was thinking that as we were talking just now, that I think I've changed in lots of different ways in the last 6 months, and tech has got part of it, but it's part of it is about what tech can do for you, and part of it is about what we should be doing with tech. to explain that, you know, we've had two huge disruptors, and we live in an age of disruption, obviously, but the if you like, the mechanical disruptor of the last 6 months has been COVID, and that's interestingly driven us into the hands of another former disruptor, which was technology as a savior space. So we've been using technology very heavily, and some people perhaps who haven't subscribed to the use of technology, I'm talking about teachers particularly here, have been driven into the arms of something that they've previously seen as challenging and possibly the enemy. And people have upskilled really fast, which is great. And so there are conversations about what are we going to do after there's a re-establishment of normality. However, I think there's been another huge disruptor, which has been the philosophical, moral one of the Black Lives Matter anti-racism movement. And that's taken us to a really interesting place where it's incumbent upon us now to start questioning policies and the practices as we've had from an anti-racist point of view. And is technology racist? That's too big a question to ask. That's the whole podcast on its own. But implicitly, there are those who are advantaged and disadvantaged, and opportunities for us to perhaps think again. I don't want to get too far away from tech, Ian, in answering your question, but I think we all need to kind of go back and think about what we do with an equity lens on, and perhaps even the United World College mission doesn't have the word equity in it anywhere near it. You know, it talks about peace and sustainable futures, but you have to question peace for who, sustainable futures for whom. You know, these are all lenses you can bring to it. So I think accessibility for learners has become an absolutely critical element. I mean, we're experiencing it in our own environments, which are, let's face it, quite privileged environments. Imagine what it's like if you're not in a privileged environment and able to access tech for learning. I'll give you an example of this. At SCA, we've been working for the last 2 or 3 years with a group who were originally named Sky School, but they've had to rebrand because Sky didn't like them using the name. And they're now called Amala, which means spirit. And they were two entrepreneurial students who left different UWC colleges and set up an amazing personal investment of time, set up a virtual school for the refugee nation. You know, the refugee nation, people probably know, has got something like 80 million people in it. It's 10 times larger than Hong Kong and some. And they've made available to refugee high schoolers graduation certificate, 10 courses, 100 hours each, which will give them a high school graduation potential from anywhere in the world. So that the journey of verifying that, authenticating it, selling it to universities, actually getting the tech to the right places for access has been amazing. But it's actually a high school you can take on your phone. So to answer your question, I think technology is great and AI will be brilliant, and we can perhaps get our students into even more funky experiences. But for me, what's changed in my thinking in the last 6 months is that's not really the point. The point is that we should all become warriors to take technology into spaces where it doesn't reach, you know, even back to the hole in the wall computer project years and years ago. That's what we should be doing. That's what, from the space of privilege we occupy, demands us to do that and to make sure that everyone can do what we can do. So, tech's brilliant. It's massive, and it's massively more important than it was now in my head, but for perhaps not the reasons you might think.
A good answer, Graham, and certainly the Amala initiative that you mentioned there. I mean, my brother works with, you know, migrants arriving in York in England, and I'm going to mention that whole initiative to him. I think he'd be very excited to hear about it. Clay, I was wondering, as you know, Mr. Silverthorne was providing the details of that, whether that has some kind of impact on your You Matter initiative that you talked about on the show earlier in the year, whether there could be some kind of synergy there, perhaps.
Definitely. Yeah, I think the thing in common between the two initiatives is that it's warping what it means to have an education in the 21st century. Essentially, we're looking at education in different forms, not only physically sitting down in a classroom and being lectured by a teacher, but we're taking things into our own hands. So we have a lot of MOOCs, I'm not sure if you guys have heard of that, massive online open courses. And the prevalence of that is giving a lot of people access to degree courses or programs that they normally wouldn't have the financial resources to take. So I think online classes can be used as a springboard for a top-tier education. And Mr. Silverthorne, I completely agree with your point in saying that before going into the technological developments and the flashy lights and the AI, it's important to go back to our roots and use tech to help people that really need it the most. So that's the core of what we do, providing equity between students with special needs and mainstream students, but equally to students that don't have the physical means to attend a school or may not have access to a physical campus. I think online learning is definitely something that is going to increase equity in the near future.
And is tech racist? I think that sounds like, you know, a very interesting segue into a future episode or something along those lines. I can't think of anything at the moment in the world that's more topical than those kind of discussions.
Definitely. I think tech is classist, but we'll come back to that on another show. Yeah. So if I can perhaps bring in my fellow students at this stage, I'd love to hear what you guys think. Rohan, Paul, what are your thoughts on this current online situation? And maybe you could talk about the Amala initiative that you found interesting and even other points that have been made by principals. What do you guys think?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that one thing for sure is that a day off due to inclement weather definitely doesn't exist anymore. I think this is the new norm, as Mr. Silverthorne described as sort of redefining normality. And also, I understand that many schools have had the concern of student engagement, and teachers couldn't really tell if students were engaging in the lesson or not, because we may have learned talking on Zoom is a rarity for some or even many students. So in that sense, I think the policy of having cameras on, which we, I believe, have started doing this year, setting aside its setbacks, such as privacy issues, or that some may argue, it was definitely a step up. And as a school, I think we're moving closer to the level of efficacy that we would normally produce in the classroom. And the mindset that Mr. Williamson talked about at the very beginning, of not really a temporary thing, but sort of a status quo, I think is a very important mindset for a lot of us. I think teachers and students, I think principals as well. At first, I think many of us thought it would be just a thing that would go on for a couple of weeks or to a month and we would just get over it. But I think now we have to forget about the end of it, just keep going and just focus on the present, I guess, and continue adapting to the online environment that we are given to face with.
Spot on, Paul. I mean, that's pretty much the way, Tom, that you started the year, wasn't it? That we've got to think of ourselves as an online school, not just a school per se anymore, but we do online learning. That's you know, what we've done since the beginning of this school year and did for several months before.
Absolutely. And, you know, to be clear, I wasn't saying by that, you know, we'll never go back face to face. We obviously hope we will as soon as possible. But it was exactly Paul's point. It was live in the present, embrace the present, embrace what we've got now and be happy for what we've got now. And I think if we look at, you know, some of the points that have been made earlier, you know, we are the lucky ones because we are of a class and an economic group and a country and a situation and, you know, arguably a race too, although I think we embrace multiple races here. You know, we are in a situation where we've got the equality, we've got the opportunity, to have these devices. So let's make the most of them rather than seeing it as in some way a problem.
Well, first of all, I'd have to agree with Paul. I think having the cameras on in the lessons has been much better to be able to engage with our fellow classmates and teachers alike. I certainly feel that I'm more connected to the school community than was previously the case when we didn't have the cameras on, albeit virtually. I certainly think that both students and teachers have gotten much better at teaching and learning online, respectively, than was previously the case when we started all of this back in February. And from a personal perspective, I find it very easy to take advantage of learning online in terms of using the opportunity to take screenshots of the slides that the teachers may be presenting on when they're sharing their screen. And it may have been more difficult to do in a physical classroom environment because I know that some teachers don't like it when students take their photos out to take, or take their phones out rather, to take a photo of what's on the board. But something else that I've noticed is that mindfulness has become more important than perhaps ever for staff and students, as all of my teachers have been regularly encouraging me and my classmates to take breaks during the lesson away from our screens, and this acknowledges the challenges of sitting in front of a screen for 6 hours a day. And just to go back to Mr. Silverthorne and the initiative that he was talking about, the Amala initiative, I would love to see that start to be publicised around our school. I think it would be really important for the students to know about this, and I think there were some really interesting points that were being made from that.
Somebody's going to be thinking here, one of the listeners, and I would imagine there'll be Year 12, CAS project. That's what I think's going on there. There's a CAS project in the offing, I think. Tom, given the points that have just been made by Paul and Rohan, as well as the example from UWC East that we were hearing, how do you rate the quality of online learning that we've seen at South Island during 2020? I mean, you know, Rohan was giving us a very positive bit of feedback there. What about from your perspective as the principal?
Thank you. Well, firstly, it's good to have the positive feedback. Perhaps I can loop back to some of the earlier points made whilst hopefully answering that question, Ian. Mr. Silverthorne's talked about disruption. And when I was growing up, disruption was a bad word. But now there's the concept of positive disruption. And I think we've all very much seen that in action. I mean, we've all been disrupted in our lives, no question. Yet, you know, if I look at the South Island School Development Plan, things have, in most cases, accelerated beyond where they would be if that disruption hadn't happened. Very interesting to hear John Ray's points about interactive whiteboards, and also there's been mention of iPads. I remember both coming in when I worked in the UK. Interactive whiteboards were proudly announced by UK local education authorities as, we're going to install one in every school and that'll solve everything. And I also remember the day I first encountered an iPad, when a teacher was proudly presenting to other teachers what it could do, and she showed how you could write your name on it with your finger. And I remember, holding up a pen and a piece of paper, skeptic as I was in those days, and saying, I can do that already, and it's cheaper than your iPad. So I think initially there was just a thought, there's a gadget, it's expensive, so it must be good, so let's have it, and let's do it. And so these gadgets appeared, but nobody really necessarily knew what to do with them or why. And what was perhaps missing was the vision of how to use them and the sense of purpose of how they would enhance learning. And so I think to come back to the point, what have we seen in online learning? We've seen teachers really understand the power of the devices. We've seen students understand and parents too. We've seen a real intentionality to the use that probably wasn't maybe there in every case previously, where there will have been champions of technology, such as those in this episode today, but there will have been others who, they've got their laptop because Mr. Ray introduced laptops for all, 10 to 15 years ago. But I think now everybody's got that vision, everybody's got that intentionality. And so it's given the learning purpose during distance learning. And what I think is really exciting is that we can hopefully sustain that into the physical world when we come back face to face. So I think there are really high opportunities there. Also, coming back to some of the other forms of disruption Mr. Silverthorne mentioned, interesting to hear mention of the Black Lives Matter movement, and also the comments about laptop inequality. One of our drives at the moment is very much to look at diversity, equality and inclusion, and certainly some great ideas there that I'm sure existing South Island groups like the DLC and the Making a Difference Council will want to listen to carefully and pick up and take forward. I think one of the things that the technology does is it does allow inclusion of individual students as long as they have some access. A key point of what we're doing at South Island is to empower the students. We know in any case that the younger generation are always ahead of us old timers where tech is concerned. And so, we have to harness that energy, and we're doing it today, clearly with our students leading the show. But also at South Island, we've talked about independent learning rather than homework. And there was this sort of concept before that there's classwork that happens in the classroom, and then there's homework, which happens elsewhere. And I think those boundaries are just gone now. Independent learning is woven into the fabric of what we do because our students are empowered to learn independently throughout the learning process. And if I can just make one other point about what I think we've gained, there's been mention of the possibility of global synchronous learning. Obviously, very exciting possibilities to have people tune in from the other side of the world in real time. In fact, that's exactly what we're doing now, with Mr. Silverthorne in Singapore and Mr. Ray in Canada. Also, I think there are great possibilities for asynchronous learning, and this may be the way in which we perhaps break down some of those inequality barriers, because although it's great that our students and our staff have their own laptops, it's not strictly necessary that everybody owns a device in order for them to be able to access some of the learning opportunities that are out there. The key point is that they've got some access to the device. So perhaps if we look at the ways of breaking down you know, the device classist inequality, it's going to be about access as opposed to ownership. If we take perhaps an underprivileged community and we look at a way in which we can at least give a device that can be shared, that's a really positive step forward, because then, you know, the instructional learning can be accessed for asynchronous independent learning in people's real times. So exciting times. I'm not sure if we've really answered, if I've really answered the question there, Ian, about the quality of online learning. But I think the one thing I would highlight is that we've all had to learn, you know, very much teachers included, and I'm sure parents too, we've all had to learn how to learn, and we're just thinking about what learning is in a very different way. And that includes things like working out when not to be online. You know, we talk about distance learning. Distance learning doesn't necessarily mean online learning. It means using the tech to its maximum capacity, but it also means recognizing when, you know, looking at a screen is not necessarily better than other alternatives. And, you know, that takes me full circle to the point about iPads, where, you know, we're now harnessing the power of the iPad, but let's not get hung up in saying that an iPad is necessarily better than something else intrinsically. It has its purpose that we can use. So I think very exciting times. Disruption has certainly occurred, positive disruption. And I think we're seeing some very, very high online learning taking place. Certainly, if our IB and IGCSE results are anything to go by. Of course, there were you know, political issues connected to that, but you know, we've seen actually our best results ever this year. So that is one piece of evidence to suggest that this has been overall beneficial rather than really a problem.
That was a very good save there, Tom. When you were talking about pen and paper, I thought we might have to banish you to a breakout room there for a minute. So it was a good save in the second half of your answer. It seems to me, Tom, that collecting data, yeah, from our various different stakeholders has been really crucial this year. I mean, I think every couple of weeks, it seemed to me, as we were going through February, March, April, there was another survey in the field. I'm reminded of this, by the way, because I've been watching The West Wing again recently, and they're constantly polling in The West Wing, if you've ever seen that series. So the ability to collect data that we've been talking about over the last 5 years, you know, it's been, you know, big data, and big data literacy has been something we've heard time and time again from big tech companies, etc. Obviously, that wouldn't have been possible 20 years ago. And I'm guessing this is providing the leadership team in the school with a real sense of confidence when it comes to assessing the strategic decisions made and the quality of the online learning that you've just been talking about there.
Thank you, Ian. Yes, I think it is. It's interesting you mentioned data. I mean, data is all around us now. We are generating data through this episode, and that will be a piece of data going forwards. I think there are different types of data and different purposes. As an English teacher myself, you know, the one thing I used to dread was actually the marking. You know, it's not that I don't like reading students' work. I always find it interesting and empowering, but it takes a long time, especially when you have very talented students who've, you know, written several thousand words. It takes a long time to work through. Now we have other ways of checking understanding. You know, if we think of data collection online apps like Kahoot and so on, where, you know, rather than necessarily having to spend hours reading something very long, we can check at the click of a button whether our students have understood or not. So I think this has been incredibly powerful for formative assessment through online learning. If we look again at Padlet as another device where, you know, we're collecting student feedback together rather than, you know, one at a time, and it's just much more efficient. So I think firstly, the formative assessment data that we're gathering as staff, as teachers, is extremely useful. We've always had our student summative assessment data. I've referenced exam results. This is still there in a range of forms, but I think the tech allows us now to triangulate things in so many different ways. If I look at what the exam boards asked us to do, they asked us to, you know, have evidence of how we arrived at our centre assessed grades. And so, of course, summative assessment data is very important for that. You've mentioned surveys, feedback, collation of opinion. Yes, identifying trends is very easy now through, you know, apps like SurveyMonkey or through Google is, you know, another way of doing this. The dark side of data, if you like, is what one might call big brother data. There's obviously lots of fears to do with privacy at this moment in time. You know, there are advantages to being able to check, you know, logs of who's done what, you know, in the unlikely event of a Zoom bombing, but, you know, it can happen occasionally, you know, the ability to go back and check data. But I've been told off for mentioning pen and paper earlier, so I'm going to risk another moment of that sort and say, for all the data we've got, there's actually no substitute still for talking with people face to face, because I think that's how you truly capture the emotional data. And that, of course, is one of the reasons to reference the earlier point about cameras, why we're putting cameras on in our Zoom calls, because ultimately that face-to-face connection is the most important thing.
Just a very quick update on what is happening with online learning at the International School of Vancouver. We've been in quite a different situation here in that we are now back face-to-face, but we've had three different experiences of online learning, which has been incredibly valuable as we plan for the future. Firstly, we went to synchronous online learning, very successful. We then partially returned to school face-to-face. So we had a blended learning model with half the lessons online and half the lessons face-to-face. And then we went to a situation where we were in hybrid learning, where the students could choose whether they chose to return to class or not. So our teachers have had three very different experiences of this kind of this scenario. And the really exciting thing is, on the basis of those experiences, the teachers are very excited about piloting and trialing different of the different online methods for their classes going forward. So, you know, just a quick snapshot of how things have been in Western Canada and some of the opportunities that have come out of the changing scenario for us. Also, just quickly want to throw in one comment about the DEI agenda and just acknowledge so how important that is for every school in the world at the moment. And I do want to just mention that if you look at the history of South Island, we've had six white British males as principals of the school. And that's something, after you, Tom, that ESF needs to do something about.
Thank you for that point, John. That's very important right now. It's very high on our agenda to look at how we really embed our thinking. And it's easy for us to say we're international because we have lots of nationalities. It's easy to say we're international because we engage internationally through Making a Difference projects and other such initiatives. But we're looking at how we embed things deeper than that.
Yeah, I think we've just fringed around something really important here around learning, which is we've started an R&D in understanding why it is, and it's very clear already that the students, some students who went remote, have done better than we expected, and some who went remote haven't, which makes a really interesting point about standardized assessments. It's not only the standard of the assessment, it's the medium of the learning, which is part of the process. And to me, I think in gazing into the future, standardized assessments are in big trouble as a method of measuring anything. But it's really been interesting. There's lots of learning, and John's description of the different phases of learning was similar to ours, not the last part. But we have to find not only the right curriculum to demonstrate the talents of our learners. We also have to find the right methodology by which they can learn and fulfill themselves. And this is a great opportunity to learn here.
I think many of our listeners would be interested to hear what you all think the biggest tech challenges have been for each of you at your time in SIS. So if you could each perhaps pick one thing and keep it brief, keep it to 1 minute each.
Yeah, happy to talk about that, Chloe. Thank you. I think that by far and away the biggest tech challenge for me at my time and for our community at SIS was the move to one-to-one technology. And I think it was a really tough decision. It was a really big decision, but it was absolutely the right one. Looking back, I think all schools around the world now, you know, are pretty much built on the notion of immediate access by students and learners and teachers to technology when it's appropriate to enhance the learning.
Graham?
Thank you, Chloe. Interestingly, I'm going to go somewhere slightly unexpectedly perhaps in my answer, because one of the learnings that I've had over the life of technology is that it doesn't matter how fancy your stuff is if you haven't got a really strong base. So I think the best thing that I did really was to invest in the Wi-Fi upgrades in the firewall, in ISAMs. Basically, if the trains don't run on time, nobody can take advantage of the technology opportunities available. So we put a lot of money into some of those things, and I think rationalized the environment from which everybody could hopefully then fly.
Mr. Benyos?
Thank you. Very clear that my predecessors have set up the infrastructure to allow us to be successful now, and I thank you both for that. My answer is simple in a way. The challenge has been to develop the distance learning pedagogy in a way that is meaningful and accessible to all. I think that's a challenge we've embraced, but you know, we probably thought we knew how to do it in February when we first went to distance learning. It's taken quite a lot of development since then to get to a stage where we feel we're really developing the online learning in a constructive way. Back again to that concept of disruption, the major challenge has been to get everybody up to speed, staff and students included, but also the major success is that we think, you know, the vast majority now are using the tech effectively. So challenging times. We couldn't have done it without the building that went before my time, but that's the journey. And I'm sure it's the same, Graham and John, for you in your current schools, that there are aspects that you've been able to build on from what you inherited.
Rohan.
So if I had to pinpoint the largest tech-related change in my time at South Island School, I think it would have to be within the maths department. All of the teachers have now converted to digital note-taking, and they're using their iPads and then sharing their notes with their students via the Google Classroom. From around year 7 to year 10 of my mathematics learning experience, I found that teachers would often use a couple of whiteboard pens on the whiteboard to show how to solve equations. However, nowadays I find that my maths teachers' notes are contained with very detailed mind maps and vigorous colour coding that makes learning mathematics more visual than ever before. And for me personally, as a mathematics student, I found that this has been fantastic because concepts have just been easier to grasp and understand than ever before, really, as a result of this transition to the more digital form of note-taking. So I would say that that's probably the largest tech-related change that I've been able to see in my time at South Island School so far.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree with Rohan, as my math teacher, at least during distance learning period, has been using his iPad a lot, and it's essentially a replacement for a classroom whiteboard, which I think is really, really cool. But for me personally, it's how the program Google Classroom has developed during my time at SIS. If I can remember correctly, Google Classroom was actually released right when my year 7 started. And at first it was just like used for notices from teachers or announcements. And then gradually more and more features were introduced, starting with assignments and then gradings. And then actually now there's a originality test function, which I don't know is used that often. The point is it's so sophisticated now. I remember back in year 7 or earlier, back in primary, where all the homework had to be printed and submitted via a hard copy. I'm sure it was a nightmare for some teachers to organize everything and just a waste of paper in general. So in my opinion, Google Classroom development was absolutely vital moving forward, and it's made electronic submitting so easy for everyone.
Absolutely, and hence the term virtual classroom, which Miss Andrews has been using since the beginning of the year. And certainly coming back to the point that you made there about the submission of work, I mean, the originality check is now a pretty routine part of the way in which work is submitted to school, which the majority of teachers, certainly for formal pieces of work, summative assessments, etc., are likely to use. You know, we have something called ICT strategy group meeting. Happens, you know, once every month or so. There are people like Mr. Vignoles, of course, who's part of the discussion today, and Mr. Slethog and a few others who are involved. And it was actually suggested a while ago by Dr. Bushell that maybe all of Year 7 should get iPads rather than laptops. Now, there were lots of discussions about that at the time. We felt that perhaps there was still a more of a holistic need to have the laptop rather than the iPad as a whole, just at the moment. But I do wonder whether over the next couple of years there might even be, you know, opportunities there where the iPad, or not even the iPad, but just a digital tablet device becomes the focus point for those, particularly in the lower school years.
One thing that I find quite interesting is that, as we'd mentioned before, Apple's marketing team has obviously with the release of the newest iPad Pro, has been suggesting that it is somewhat, it's now more of a computer than it is an iPad. So I do wonder whether in the future they will consider to be sort of like a combined device. They'll be used both as an iPad at times for lessons such as mathematics and physics, science, etc. And whether in some subjects like English and media, whether they'll be used more as laptops. So I just thought I'd put that one out there just as something maybe to think about for all the viewers out there.
So rather than looking back over the last 20 years, let's turn our attention to the future, if we may. Tom, I'm going to leave you with the final thoughts here. As we look forward to the next 5 years and hopefully a post-COVID world, where do you see the biggest changes coming at South Island School?
Thank you, Ian. If there have been some quite dramatic changes, I think it will now be about evolution, not revolution. We're in a situation where we've got our direction now. We know what to do, but we're going to want a real sense of blended learning in the classroom, where what we've learned in the last year or so, and indeed before, is very much embedded into everything we do. There is one revolution, though, that I wonder if it needs to come, and I'll leave this as my final thought. We put a lot of our energies, and I'm sure Graham and John did too, to looking at how on earth our external exam students, our Year 13 IB and our Year 11 IGCSE students, could do their exams. And of course, we know that ultimately these were cancelled and that other things were put in place. I wonder if this is the moment where, instead of giving people grades by asking them to scan in a handwritten mock exam script, this might be the moment where the IBO and the other exam boards might want to look at a future of online exams. And I'll leave that as a challenge to the exam boards out there. We hope they pick up this show on Spotify or some other method and think about that thought. How much easier would it have been if that had been the case in this year of all years?
Interesting point to finish on. Well, that's just about all we have time for today. I'd like to thank my guests. Thank you to Tom, thank you to Graham, and thank you to John. Brilliant to have you all on the show, and hopefully we can get you back on again at some point in the future. And just before we have any members of the audience pointing out that actually there was another principal during the period between 2000 and 2020, or at least a temporary one, don't worry, we will have Annette Chapman on the show as part of the new series. I spoke to her via Facebook Messenger over the weekend. She is well, and she's looking forward to contributing in one of our future episodes.
Rest assured, we'll be back soon with more tech-related content, but in the meantime, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. What would you like for us to discuss? If you have any thoughts, questions, or feedback, then please write to digileaders@webmail.sis.edu.hk. And that's DIGI Leaders. As always, thanks for listening.